Chapter 8, The Flying Years. There had been 32 of those years, but they will not continue into the future. I was 53 years old when I started flying. That's the age when sensible men and women quit flying. Too old. Flying is for young people. But that's when Charlie started. And 12 years later, I got my instrument rating so I could fly in and above the clouds with the airliners when all other planes are on the ground weathered in. I was 65 years old then. Airlines pension their pilots off at 60. Too old, can't hack it anymore. But that's when Charlie started flying in the clouds, and then 20 more years went by. But it didn't come easy. For years, I had stood at airports in Duluth and the Twin Cities watching small planes come and go. It all seemed so complicated, I always chickened out. Then came Marshfield and the airport there. It was quiet and serene with hardly any planes touching down. I picked up a small amount of courage and I approached the airport manager, Roy Schray, and asked if he thought I could fly. He grabbed me by the arm and led me to his Cessna 150 trainer plane, pushed me in, and we were off. I liked it. Well, sort of. After 4 or 5 hours of instruction over a couple of weeks, I broke the news to June. We were seated on bar stools at Murphy's Bar and Lounge in Minneapolis. After half a Manhattan, and with the false courage that comes with alcohol, I blurted out the news. I was flying. Stunned, June banged her glass down on the bar and said, "By golly, there is some life left in the old boy yet." Then she quickly added, "But I will never fly with you." A week later, she came around with, "When do you think you'll be far enough along so we can fly down to Texas to visit Brother Bob?" You have to give the girls a little time to get used to the idea. But it did not come easy. Roy was the kind of instructor who yelled at students. That's the way he learned to fly, and by golly, that's the way he was going to teach. After a grueling, nerve-wracking hour in the air, I would crawl out of the plane, hang on to the strut, and ask myself, "Charlie, is this something you really want to do?" But I realized, by then, I was too far down the road to turn back. I had June and 4 teenage sons watching Dad, wondering if he was going to chicken out. Besides, I was aware that in all recorded history, no Swede had ever chickened out because the going got too tough, and I was not going to be the first one. So I kept on, even though sometimes I would look down from 5,000 feet and wonder what I was doing up there. Of course, I did other dumb things. I bought my plane and took my lessons in it. Suppose I had found flying was not for me. I would have had a plane on my hands and no desire to fly it. The plane was 5 years old and cost me $6,500. Today, the market value of my plane is $25,000. Planes do not wear out. They sit in dry hangars and keep on increasing in value. In my first flying across country, I had no electronic guidance machines whatsoever. I navigated with an aeronautical map on my lap, flying from town to town, watching for the names of towns on water towers. Surprisingly, I never got lost. My instructor had taught me that railroads always lead to towns, and towns have water towers with names on them. Today, I have 5 different electronic receivers, including one that works from satellites, and I cannot get lost, which is wonderful. Until a fuse blows. Then I'm back to a chart on my lap following railroads that lead to towns with water towers. Now with my plane, I could fly down to stockholder meetings in Sioux City, Iowa, instead of driving there. It was 2 3/4 hours in my plane, all day by car. It was a leisurely flight with a fuel and coke stop at Mason City, Iowa. This one time I suddenly became very ill with the flu while at Sioux City, and my only thought was to get home, not wanting to be sick in a strange hotel. I climbed in the plane and headed east and home. Very sick, I huddled over the controls at 5,500 feet and let the automatic pilot fly the plane. Coming to Mason City, I saw that I was fat on fuel, so I just kept on going. Approaching Marshfield, I radioed ahead, asking the airport operator to call June and have her at the airport when I arrived. I crawled out of the plane and into her car, letting someone else put the plane in the hangar. June insisted we go to the hospital, but I refused. A strange, sterile, noisy hospital is no place for a sick man. He should be in his own home, taken care of by a loving family. In a few days, I recovered, but looking back, I realized that the people on the ground in Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin were unaware that lonely plane was overhead winging its way home with a very sick man at the controls. Those were hectic years. The Sioux City stockholders seemed to want to see me often. Travel there by car or by commercial plane was too time-consuming. Going there by my plane was the only practical answer. Then, too, I was building my new radio station, KVBR, in Brainerd, and for the first 3 years I had a manager there while I was fully occupied in Marshfield and Merrill. Travel to Brainerd was a comfortable 2-hour trip in my plane. It was 4 to 5 hours each way by car. I could get over to Brainerd in the morning and return in the afternoon in my plane. In no way could I do that in a car. In a car, it was hills and curves, crossroads, little towns, traffic lights, a struggle all the way. In my plane, it was a relaxed ride with no stops, watching the landscape slide by below. My new radio station seemed to require constant attention, so I saw lots of landscapes slide by. I took over my station, KVBR, in 1967, and from then on did a lot of radio reporting from the plane over my station. I would fly over the area, reporting on the scene below, where the fishermen are, fall color leaves, traffic, ice going out of the lakes, just anything of interest. One day a lady advertiser called the station with a change of copy. I answered the phone, and as we ended the conversation, she asked me who I was. I told her I was the good-looking one at KVBR. Do you know she did not know who that was? Then I said my name was Charlie, and she said, "Oh, you're the one who flies." So that was the public perception. After years of managing and owning a radio station, I was known only as the fellow who flies the airplane. But the station was sold, and the new owners were not interested in my doing any flying reporting, so my flying got down to occasional flying to some nearby airport for no reason at all. Then, on this last September, I flew into Mora, Minnesota Airport and carelessly made a very bad landing and demolished the plane. After 32 years and over 1,000 landings and takeoffs, I made a bad landing. I crawled out of the wreck with only a tiny cut on my forehead. Two police cars and an ambulance came roaring up, and I asked, "Does anybody have a Band-Aid?" No one has one, but they insist I go to the hospital. Regulations, they say. So I ride to the hospital where a doctor tells me I'm okay and tells me to go home. He has sick patients to take care of. A grandson drives over from Brainerd to pick me up and take me home. The insurance company labels the plane a total and pays me off with full insurance plus paying the $678 hospital bill and tells me to go and buy another plane. I bought a new car instead. Through the years, I wrote a few flying articles which were published in Pilot magazine. Here are a couple of them. The below was published in Pilot magazine, which is the official magazine of the Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association, with worldwide distribution of about 300,000, published February 1973. A little tongue-in-cheek hangar flying in which may be found some handy hints on how not to improve the image of the private pilot. It Wasn't Funny at the Time, by Charles B. Persons. You laugh about it afterwards, but when it's happening, it's pretty grim, and you're not laughing at all. In fact, you're pretty confused, and your only thought is getting down alive. Nobody's laughing at the time except maybe bystanders, but mostly they're wondering what the heck that guy is up to. In my 10 years of flying, there have been moments like that. For example, the time I landed at Glenview Naval Air Station in Chicago. This was early in my flying, but I did know you were not supposed to land at a military airport except if you had a real emergency and were in peril of life and limb. Then maybe it was okay, but never on a sunny Saturday afternoon, no emergency situation at all except maybe between the ears, where the gears were not meshing worth a darn. I was new in the Chicago area and had landed at DuPage County Airport, then headed for Pewaukee. I picked up the mic and unicommed into Palwaukee, asking for the active runway. A voice told me to use the north-south runway and land to the south. With big jets lunging toward O'Hare off my left wing and small aircraft like specks left and right, I was too busy looking for traffic to pay much attention to the ground. But I did see an airport with a north-south runway, and down I swooped, banging down on the runway in the manner of new pilots. As I taxied out, a Navy truck swung alongside and Navy men piled out, surrounding the plane. They had real guns, too. My first thought was, what's the Navy doing at Palwaukee? My second and more intelligent thought was, what airport is this? I swung the door and asked, isn't this Palwaukee? A burly Navy lieutenant replied, you are at the Glenview Naval Air Station, and the commander wants to see you. Well, I'm sure he did. As we taxied toward a big stone building, I thought, what happens now? Do they confiscate the plane? How many hours will they hold me while they check me out? How many forms to fill out? How much do they fine you? These are not happy thoughts when you're trying not to taxi into a Navy truck just ahead of you. Obviously, they thought I was a Russian spy, even though I was not a dark-haired thin man with narrow slits for eyes wearing a raincoat and slouch hat. I knew that dumpy, gray-haired fellows who look like businessmen make the best spies, and that's what I was, a gray-haired businessman, I mean. Inside the stone building, a steely-eyed naval commander was waiting for me, a sectional chart in hand. Everyone in the room was quiet and grim. I thought it was time to brighten up the atmosphere a little, so I nervously laughed and said, well, I suppose this has happened before. Only the commander answered, pointing to two airports on the sectional. This is where you are, and this is where you are going. Go out to the intersection, take off to the south, turn right across the highway, and follow the highway to Palwaukee. Then, for the first time, I said something intelligent. Yes, sir, I said, and turned and walked out. On my way out, a Navy man asked me if I had a certain frequency on my radio, and I said I did not. It was likely a Navy frequency, and if I had it, I suppose they would have put me in irons, but quick. The Navy man told me, watch for the green light from the tower. I crawled into my plane and taxied down the wide taxi strip as a big Navy four-engine job landed and rolled out past me, its occupants obviously wondering what a civilian was doing at Glenview. I was wondering about that myself right about then. At the intersection, I swung around, looking at the tower. In my short flying career, I'd never seen a tower light. Was it dim? Was it bright? Was it a pencil-thin light? What did it look like? I'd better not miss it. Then it came on, and the whole tower lit up green. It was the brightest green light I'd ever seen, and it was saying, get out of there and fast. I got out and am never going back there again except as an invited guest, which is not likely. Tower men are pretty reasonable, but they have problems too, like ulcers or difficult children, or a wife who thinks $25 is about the right price to pay for a hat when all reasonable men know that price is much too high. Or maybe they have a boss who has the same problems and thinks the way to solve them is to ride the guys under him in the tower. Then, too, tower men have other problems, such as guys like me, who just don't seem to follow directions. This time, the locale was the municipal airport at Sioux City, Iowa. I'd been told to use runway 22, but I was too busy landing the plane to pay much attention to which runway I was coming down on. When I land a plane successfully, on any runway, it's an accomplishment. I wish people wouldn't get so picky about which one. So this time, I landed on runway 17, which pretty much lies in the same direction anyway. As I rolled down the runway, the tower controller rasped, 6-4 Bravo, we'd like to have planes land on the runway we assigned them. I knew I had to say something, so I responded, sorry, I'm new at flying, which is always an acceptable excuse and is the one I use even today, after 10 years and 800 hours of flying. Who's lying? Fly with me sometime, and you'll be convinced I am new at flying. The tower men at St. Paul, Minnesota downtown airport may have an opinion on this point, too, though I'm sure they couldn't put it on paper and send it through the U.S. mail. For example, there was the time last fall when the tower told me to land on runway 26. I saw a runway running roughly east and west, so I bore down on it. Just before touchdown, the tower controller screamed at me, 6-4 Bravo, you're landing on a taxi strip. Pull up and go around. Hell, that taxi strip was wider and longer than most runways I've landed on. Of course, it did not have the number 26 painted on the end, but who pays any attention to those numbers anyway? We all know they are painted there by good union painters who know nothing about aviation and who certainly are not precision pilots like me. I pulled up and wandered around until I found a runway with 26 on it. It seemed foolish when I could have landed on that taxi strip just as well, but each airport seems to have its own set of rules, and I try to go along with them because I want to do everything I can to improve the private pilot's image around the country. The tower men sometimes get a little short-tempered and bark at me, but they are human too. Another time, at that same airport, ground control told me to taxi to runway 30. I thought I had, but when I switched to the tower frequency, the controller said, "You're at runway 26. Then there was a pause, and he added, "Aw, go ahead anyway." I suppose he figured if he had directed me to another runway, I might have wandered all over the field, so he decided to get rid of me as quickly as possible. After all, the controller's job is to expedite the flow of traffic, isn't it? But I suspect it is Duluth International Airport where I am not overly welcome, and I really don't know why, as I am the friendly, lovable type. I had been flying only a few months, and it was my first time in and out of the airport. On leaving, I asked ground control for a runway. He directed me to the intersection straight ahead of me on runway 27. But my instructor had told me, always take off from the end of a runway. Always crowd the end of the runway, he used to say. The runway behind you is worthless to you. Remembering my instructor's words, I pushed the mic button and told ground control I thought I should go to the end of the runway. He replied with a voice dripping with sarcasm, at that intersection, you have 7,500 feet of runway in front of you. Do you still want to go to the end of the runway? I weighed my situation. My instructor was 200 miles away, but this ground control character was a few yards from me, and it was his airport, so I said, I'll accept the intersection. Well, it was winter. The temperature was hovering around zero, and there was a 10-knot headwind. My lightly loaded Cessna was airborne in about 500 feet. Now, I had a new problem. No one had ever told me about asking the tower permission to make a turn after liftoff. Following my instructor's admonition to always fly to the end of the runway before turning, I flew and flew above the runway, thinking I would never come to the end. Then the friendly tower man solved my problem. 6-4 Bravo, he said, will you make a left turn and get the heck out of here? The following summer, I came back again, figuring by then it would be safe. For landing, the tower assigned me runway 31, and seconds later assigned runway 3 to a North Central Airlines plane coming from the south. But I was slow in getting down. The scenery around there is tremendous, and to enjoy it is one reason you fly. As I touched down, the tower screamed at me that such and such section of the FARs required me to come to a full stop before reaching the intersection. Just then I saw the North Central plane touching down on his runway. At that moment, I suppose it looked as though North Central and I were going to meet at the intersection. Well, sir, I did not feel like getting out the FARs right then to see if the tower was quoting them correctly, so I just stood on the brakes and came to a full stop, a good 100 yards short of the intersection, just as the North Central plane flashed through it. No problem, my plane had good brakes. Why get so excited? But I suppose now there is a notice on the wall at the Duluth International Airport tower that says, when November 8064 Bravo comes in, declare an emergency and reroute all other planes to alternate airports. Of course, if the Duluth Towermen don't want me to come in there, they can say so, but I still like them. One of them is a son of a friend of mine, and this son is a real nice guy. I carry fearless passengers, too, like my wife June. She has complete confidence in me when we fly, which is strange, because on the ground she has none. But when we were both new at flying in my 6-year-old used Cessna 172, the door on her side liked to pop open when we got up to cruising altitude. At that moment, she would be looking straight down 6,000 or 8,000 feet through the open door. She would just reach around and slam it closed, and the conversation would go something like this. Charlie, why don't you fix that door? I'm going to. I just haven't gotten around to it yet. Well, you would if it were on your side. And I guess I would, too. Of course, June does have some doubts about my navigation. On one trip to Marshfield, Wisconsin, where we lived at the time, we had been above scattered clouds. As we neared Marshfield from the west, I thought we should get down underneath, which we did. What I didn't know, however, was that the wind direction was different under the clouds. After a bit, June pointed at the town below us and asked what town that was. I told her it was Thorpe. Well, she said, if that is Thorpe, then why do they have Owen painted on the water tower? It was then that I spotted railroad tracks I knew ran from Owen to Marshfield, and I followed them the rest of the way. Ever since, June has laughingly referred to me as the Great Navigator. I don't know about daughters. We don't have any. But we do have sons. And you'd think sons would be wild about flying, having a plane in the family and all. But it hasn't turned out like that. Now, the only way I can get my sons in the plane is at pistol point, which is not considered acceptable, especially at airports where there are spectators present. When the boys were teenagers and I was brand new at flying, we would land at an airport, roll to the gas pump, and if spectators were present, my sons would pile out of the plane, kneel down, and kiss the ground. The spectators, looking at those sweet little fellows, would decide that I was a monster and that something ought to be done about it. Fortunately, nothing ever was. There are problems in flying for which the FAA has no rules. So there you sit at 6,500 feet, fat, dumb, and happy. You're flying west, and the wind is pushing you back, but sometimes you do pass a truck on the road below, if it's going uphill. And you're at peace with the world. You have no problems. That is, you have no problems until you get ready to land. That's when things fall apart. You know exactly what to do, but there are a lot of confused people down there who do not. And it is they who mess things up. So you barrel into situations that are grim at the time, but laughable later on. You wind up with stories to tell at hangar fly-in sessions. The Below was published in Plane and Pilot magazine, July 1985, a pilot's magazine with nationwide distribution. It happened to me when I was new at flying, just a few flying hours after getting that private pilot ticket. Now I was a pilot. Ace, they were calling me around the home airport. They were saying it in fun, but I took it seriously. Later, I stopped believing this ace bit, and it was then I started to learn about flying. Now, with my brand new private pilot ticket, I could take the family up in my 172. Wife June came along with me on what was normally a 45-minute flight to Winona, Minnesota, Max Conrad's home airport. I had to go there to see a man on business, so on this sunny, bright spring day, we bravely set off flying southwest toward Winona from Marshfield, Wisconsin, where we lived at the time. It was about 8 a.m., and there was only a slight breeze on the runway. I noticed that it was apparently blowing considerably harder at 3,000 feet, though, because instead of 45 minutes, it took us over an hour to reach Winona. This should have told me something. A breeze, springing up in the morning, was sure to increase as the day wore on. I landed at Winona, being careful to use the right-hand landing pattern there to avoid the steep bluffs on the west side of the airport. I met our man, talked to him for a couple of hours, and by 11 a.m. we were ready to return to Marshfield. As we went out to get in our plane, I noticed a North Central Airlines plane come in and discharge its passengers. Knowing they had a schedule to keep, I revved up my engine, but did not taxi away from the gas pumps, waiting for them to taxi out and take off. They seemed in no hurry to leave, so after waiting a bit, I decided I had been courteous long enough and taxied out to the active runway, opened the throttle wide, and we were up and away. There was light turbulence on the runway. Initially, it only shook the plane a little. We were no more than 500 feet above the runway, though, when the wind grabbed the plane and started shaking us like a dog shaking a rabbit he had just caught. The spring winds from the west came boiling over the high cliffs on the west side of the airport, creating vortexes that heaved the plane up and down and sideways. June and I grabbed the handholds and just hung on. I was thoroughly frightened, thinking our plane would be turned over at any moment. I swung the control wheel frantically with my free hand, trying to counter the deep dips the wings went into. My only thought was to keep the plane upright. I was afraid to go back and land, thinking maybe it had been a sudden wind increase and landing with a high-wing plane would be all but impossible, so I started to climb. Even that early in my flying career, I knew that up there somewhere was calm air, something I needed right away. But as I fought to keep the plane upright and climb, one thought kept racing through my mind. I knew why that North Central Airlines plane had not taken off. They were experienced pilots, and they knew better than to climb back into that extreme turbulence. But, dumb little me, I had soared right up into it. So, humiliation was added to my acute state of anxiety. The only card I held in my favor in those frantic minutes was the calmness of my wife, June. She just hung on to the strap and said not a word. Had she panicked, and she was entitled to, I might have panicked too. June did not like flying, but when I had taken up flying, she said, "If Charlie is going to fly, I'm going to learn to like it." She did a lot of learning that wild morning. Minute after minute went by. I was climbing at 200 to 300 feet per minute, and I had throttled back to 80 miles an hour to reduce the stress on the wings. Maybe I had learned a thing or two in the ground school after all. I may have stalled a few times, but who would notice a little thing like a stall in that wild turbulence? After what seemed like eternity, the plane suddenly came into calm air at 6,000 feet. It came almost as a shock. There we sat, almost motionless, looking down on wild, hilly country. Nowhere could I see Winona or the Mississippi River that flows past Winona. In climbing, I had lost all track of where we were going, and now I sat there at 6,000 feet, lost. Turning on the receiver and tuning in the Winona VOR, I found my radial. Squinting down at little towns in the Wisconsin hills gave me a rough idea of where we were. We set our course northeast, and soon other little towns and a winding railroad gave us a more positive fix. We were on our way home. Something was still wrong. Our Cessna had never flown so fast before. My hands had stopped shaking enough to let me use the computer, and I estimated our ground speed at 170 miles an hour, which is pretty good for a 120-mile-an-hour airplane. We were over the Marshfield Airport in almost no time. Happily, there are no high bluffs and no nearby hills. Even if a stiff wind was blowing, it was down the runway, and the landing was uneventful. Today, after 1,000 hours of flying, I know a little more about flying than I did the day I got my private pilot ticket 12 years ago. When I look at high bluffs or hills near an airport on windy spring days, I do so with knowing eyes. There could be a king-size problem up there 1,000 or so feet above the runway, and often there is.